step up, and you look at us funny? It's them you should be asking these questions to. I would if I knew them, I said. Don't lie to me, nigger. Autry knew I was on good terms with JT, although I'd been cagey about the extent of our relationship. Many times he told me I needed to have the courage to ask JT more difficult questions about the gang, even if it would upset him. At least you can ask one of these niggers the question, he said, and he'll be here tonight. Autry let out a loud laugh and went outside to smoke his cigarette. Shit. It would be the first time I'd seen JT in several weeks. I was usually careful to ask his permission before attending any event involving gangs, both to show respect and because I needed a patron. Otherwise, as he always told me, my personal safety couldn't be guaranteed. I decided to wait outside the club to talk to JT when he arrived. Autry offered to wait with me. We stood on the sidewalk and watched the busy, noisy traffic along Federal Street. The club sat in the shadow of a project high-rise. You could hear people yelling from the sidewalk up to the open windows. There was no intercom system, and you could smell the smoke of marijuana and menthol cigarettes. Before long, JT and the leaders of the other gangs began pulling up with their respective security entourages. The scene was straight out of a gangsta rap video. Each vehicle, there were sports cars, fancy trucks, and one long purple Lincoln Continental, was immaculate, rims sparkling from a fresh wash. They drove up in a line, as if in a funeral procession, parking across the street from the club. The first man out of each car was a bodyguard, even if the gang leader was the one who drove. Autry crossed the street, as nonchalantly as his excitement allowed, to ensure them that the club was safe, neutral territory. They were all dressed similarly, new tracksuits, white sneakers, and plenty of gold on their wrists and around their necks. As they approached, each leader was trailed by one or two bodyguards, with another one or two staying behind with the cars. All the bodyguards wore sunglasses and baseball caps. JT noticed me standing there and pushed his bodyguards aside. "You all go in," he shouted to the other gang leaders. "I'll see you in a bit." Then he turned to me, he shrugged his shoulders and glared, the universal sign for what the fuck. Autry intervened before I could answer. "Hey, man," he said. "No worries, he's with me."
"He's with you." JT wasn't smiling. "You know him?"
"Yeah, big boss man. Today he's with me." Autry smiled, his front teeth glistening as he leaned over and hugged JT.
"Oh, so he's with you now," JT repeated, shaking his head. He pulled out a cigarette, and Autry lit it for him.
"Sorry," I said. "I haven't seen you in a while. Autry and I just met, and he said I could come to this meeting. I should have told you."
"Yeah, the brother didn't mean nothing," Autry said. "Not a big deal. No taping today. Right, my brother?"
Autry loved to walk into a room with me at the club and yell, "Sudhir is from the university, and he'll be taping everything you say today."
"Not a big deal," JT said, turning to Autry. "You're more ignorant than I thought you were. You pulled all these people together, and you're going to fuck it up like this."
"Whoa, my brother. Like I said, he's with me."
"And what if he comes by my building? Is he with you then, huh? Is he with you then, nigger?"
"Fuck no," Autry laughed. "Then he's with you, 'cause I ain't stepping foot in that motherfucker. Hell no."
Autry ducked inside, grinning broadly. He seemed to be having great fun.
"That's what I thought," JT said, turning to me.
"If you walk in there, the first time all these other niggers see you, then you're with Autry, not me. You didn't think about that, did you? You're a motherfucking impatient nigger, and an ignorant one. From where I stand, you walk in there, and I can't do nothing for you, no more. So it's up to you."
"I didn't think about any of this," I apologized. "I didn't know how..."
"Yeah, nigger, you didn't think." JT started walking inside. "Like I said, you're with me or you're with someone else. You decide." Inside, I could see Autry giggling at me.
"Come in, boy," he yelled. "Come in, little baby. You scared?"
I decided I wasn't willing to jeopardize my relationship with JT, even if it meant missing an opportunity to learn more about the community and the gangs. So I turned and walked away. I started toward the university and then I stopped. The last time I'd had an uncomfortable episode with JT, his beatdown of C-Note.
I'd made a mistake. I'd waited too long before speaking to him about it. That made it harder to get a satisfying explanation, so this time I headed straight for JT's building, figuring he'd go there when the meeting was over. He did. He still seemed upset and started yelling at his mother.
"No one understands what I deal with," he said. "No one listens and does what I say."
He sent his bodyguards out to buy some beer. He sat on the recliner and grabbed the remote control. He barely glanced at me.
"You pissed at me?" I asked. "What the fuck have you been doing around here?" he asked.
I explained that Miss Bailey had introduced me to Autry and that I was interested in what went on at the club. He seemed surprised that he no longer knew all the specifics about the people I was meeting.
"I guess you were going to make some friends while I was gone," he said, and then he asked a question I'd been hoping he'd never ask. "What exactly are you doing around here? I mean, what are you writing about?"
He started changing channels on the TV. It was the first time I'd ever been with him when he didn't look me in the eye.
"Well, honestly, I'm fascinated by how you do what you do," I stammered. "Like I said before, I'm trying to understand how your mind works, why you decided to come back to the neighborhood and run this organization, what you have to do to make it. But if I don't get out and see how others look at you, how you have this incredible effect on other people, then I'll never really understand what you do. So while you were gone, I thought I'd branch out."
"You mean you're asking people what they think about me?" Now he turned to look at me again.
"Well, not really, because you know that they would probably not feel comfortable telling me. I'm at stage one. I'm trying to understand what the organization does and how people have to deal with it. If you piss people off, how do they respond? Do they call the police? Do they call you?"
"Okay, so it's how others work with me." He seemed appeased, so I was quick to affirm,
"Yes, how others work with you. That's a great way of putting it."
I hoped he wouldn't ask what stage two was, for I had no idea. I felt a little uneasy letting him think that I was actually writing his biography, but at the moment, I just wanted to buy myself some time. He checked his watch.
"All right. I need to get some sleep."
He got up and walked toward his bedroom without saying goodbye. In the kitchen, Miss May kissed me goodnight, and I walked to the bus stop. JT was a little cool toward me the next few times I saw him, so to warm things up, I stopped going to the club and spent nearly all my time in and around JT's building. I was unhappy to be missing the opportunity to see how Autry worked with other people behind the scenes on important community issues, but I didn't want to further anger JT. I just told Autry that I'd be busy for a few weeks, but I'd be back once I got settled in with my coursework in the coming fall semester. Soon after the school year began, a young boy and girl in Robert Taylor were shot, accidental victims of a drive-by gang shooting. The boy was 8, the girl 9. They both spent time in the hospital, and then the girl died. The shooting occurred at the border of Taylor A and Taylor B. JT's gang had been on the receiving end of the shooting, with several members injured. The shooters were from the Disciples, who operated out of the projects near the Boys and Girls Club. This single shooting had a widespread effect. Worried that a full-scale gang war would break out, parents began keeping their children inside, which meant taking time off from work or otherwise adjusting their schedules. Senior citizens worried about finding a safe way to get medical treatment. Local churches mobilized to deliver food to families too scared to walk to the store. Miss Bailey told me about a meeting at the Boys and Girls Club where the police would address concerned parents and tenant leaders. If I really wanted to see how the gang's actions affected the broader community, Miss Bailey said, I should be there. I asked JT, and he thought it was a good idea, even though he never bothered with such things.
"Police don't do nothing for us," he said. "You should understand that by now." Then he muttered something about how the community takes care of its problems, mentioning the incident I'd seen with Boo Boo Price and the Middle Eastern store manager.
The meeting was held late one weekday morning. The streets outside the club were quiet, populated by a smattering of unemployed people, gang members, and drug addicts. The leaves had already changed, but the day was unseasonably warm. Autry was busy as usual, running to and fro, making sure everything was ready. Although I hadn't seen him in some time, he shot me a friendly glance. The meeting was held in a large, windowless concrete room with a linoleum floor. There were perhaps 40 tenants in attendance, all fanning themselves since the heat was turned up too high. "If we turn it off, we can't get it back on right away," Autry told me, "and then it's May by the time you get it back on." At the front of the room, several uniformed police officers and police officials sat behind a long table. Miss Bailey nodded me toward a seat beside her, up front and off to one side. The meeting was an exercise in chaos. Residents shouted past one another while the police officials begged for calm. A mother holding her infant yelled that she was sick and tired of living like this. The younger and middle-aged parents were the most vocal. The senior citizens sat quietly, many of them with Bibles in their hands, looking as if they were ready for church. Nor did the police have much to say, other than platitudes about their continued efforts to disrupt the gangs and requests for tenants to start cooperating with them by reporting gang crimes. After about 45 minutes, the police looked very ready to leave. So did the tenants. As the meeting broke up, some of them waved their hands dismissively at the cops. "Are these meetings always so crazy?" I asked Miss Bailey. "This is how it goes," she said. "We yell at them, they say nothing. Everyone goes back to doing what they were doing. I don't see what you get out of this. It seems like a waste of time." Miss Bailey just patted my knee and said, "Mm-hmm." "I mean it," I said. "This is ridiculous. Where I grew up, you'd have an army of cops all over the place, but nothing is going on here. Doesn't that upset you?" By now the room had cleared out, except for Miss Bailey and a few other tenant leaders, Autry, and one policeman, Officer Johnson, a tall black man who worked out of a nearby precinct. He was well-groomed, with a short mustache and graying hair. They were all checking their watches and speaking quietly to one another. I was about to leave when Miss Bailey walked over. "In 2 hours, come back here," she said, "but now you have to go." Autry smiled and winked as he passed. What was he up to? I knew that Autry was still trying to groom himself as a local power broker, but I didn't know how much power, if any, he had actually accrued. As instructed, I left for a while and took a walk around the neighborhood. When I returned to the club, Autry silently pointed me toward the room where the earlier meeting had been held. Inside, I saw Miss Bailey and some other building presidents, Officer Johnson and Autry's friend Officer Reggie, a well-liked cop who had grown up in Robert Taylor, and Pastor Wilkins, who was said to be a long-standing expert in forging gang truces. Autry, I knew, saw himself as Pastor Wilkinson's eventual successor. They were all milling about, shaking hands and chatting softly before settling into the folding metal chairs Autry had arranged. A few of them looked at me with a bit of surprise as I sat down, but no one said anything. And then, to my great surprise, I saw J.T. sitting with a few of his senior officers along one wall. Although our eyes didn't meet, I could tell that he noticed me. Even more surprising was the group on the other side of the room, a gang leader named Maine, who ran the Disciples, accompanied by his officers, leaning quietly against the wall. I took a good look at Maine. He was a heavy-set man with a crumpled face, like a bulldog's. He appeared bored and irritated, and he kept issuing instructions to his men.
"Nigger, get me a cigarette. Boy, get me a chair."
Autry walked into the room. "Okay," he shouted. "The club is closed. Let's get going. Kids are going to come back at 5. Officer Reggie stood up.
"Let's get moving," he said. "Miss Bailey, you wanted to start. Go ahead."
He walked toward the back of the room. "First, J.T., get the other men out of the room," she said. "You too, Maine." Maine and J.T. both motioned for their senior officers to leave, and they did, walking out slowly with stoic faces. Miss Bailey stood silently until they were gone. Then she took a deep breath. "Pastor, you said you had an idea, something you wanted to ask these young men."
"Yes, Miss Bailey," Pastor Wilkins said. He stood up. "Now, I know how this began. Shorty's probably fighting over some girl, right? And it got all the way to shooting each other. That's crazy.
I mean, I can understand if you were fighting over business, but you're killing people around here because of a spat in school.
We're defending our honor, Maine said. Ain't nothing more important than that.
Yeah, said JT, and it is about business. Those guys come shooting down on our end, scaring people away.
Pastor Wilkins asked Maine and JT to describe how the fight had escalated. Pastor Wilkins' original guess was mostly right. Two teenage boys at DuSable High School got into a fight over a girl. One boy was in JT's gang, the other in Maine's. Over the course of a few weeks, the conflict escalated from unarmed to armed, first a knife fight, then a drive-by shooting. The shooting occurred during the afternoon while kids were playing outside after school. JT said that since his customers had been scared off since the shooting, and because tenants in his buildings were angry about their lives being interrupted, he wanted Maine to pay a penalty. Maine argued that the shooting took place at the border of the two gangs' territory, near a park that neither gang claimed. Therefore, he argued, JT was ineligible for compensation. My mind raced as they spoke. I couldn't believe that a religious leader and a police officer were not only watching this mediation, but were actually facilitating it. What incentive did they have to do so, and what would happen if people from the community found out they were helping gang leaders settle their disputes? I was also struck by how level-headed everyone seemed, even JT and Maine, as if they'd been through this before. These were the same two gang leaders, after all, who had been trying to kill each other quite literally with drive-by shootings. I wondered if one of them might even pull a gun here at any moment. Perhaps the very strangest thing was how sanguine the community leaders were about the fact that these men sold crack cocaine for a living. But at this moment, it seemed that pragmatism was more important than moralism. After a while, the conversation got bogged down, with JT and Maine merely restating their positions. Autry jumped in to try to refocus things.
"How much you think you lost?" he asked JT. "I mean, you don't need to tell me the amount, but how many days did you lose business?"
"Probably a few days, maybe a week," JT said.
"Okay, well, we're going to bank this," Autry said. "Put it in the bank."
"What the fuck does that mean?" Maine asked.
"Nigger, that means you messed up," Autry told him. "JT didn't retaliate, did he? I mean, he didn't shoot over at you. It was just you shooting down at his end, right? So, JT gets to sell his shit in the park for a week. The next time this happens and JT fucks up, you get to sell your shit in the park for a week."
Ms. Bailey spoke up. "You all do not get to sell nothing when the kids are there, okay? Just late at night."
"Sounds fine to me," JT said. Maine nodded in agreement.
"Then we have a truce," Pastor Wilkins said. He walked over to JT and Maine. "Shake on it."
JT and Maine shook hands, not warmly and not willing to look at each other. The pastor and Miss Bailey each let out a sigh. As JT, Maine, and Pastor Wilkins sat down to work out the details of the deal, I walked out front. There was Autry smoking a cigarette on the sidewalk. He shook his head. He looked fatigued.
"This stuff is hard, isn't it?" I asked.
"Yeah, I try to block out the fact that they could get pissed at me and kill me if I say something they don't like. You never know if they'll go home and think you're working for the other side."
"You ever get hurt before?"
"I got my ass kicked a few times, one time real bad, 'cause they thought I wasn't being fair. I'm not sure I want to have that happen again."
"You don't get paid enough," I said. JT came out of the club and stopped beside me. His head was lowered. Autry moved away.
"You wanted this, right?" he asked.
"Yes," I said. "This is what I'm looking for." He knew I'd been eager to see how the community and the gang worked out their differences, but he'd also made it clear that I could do so only if I had a patron, and I had to choose between JT and Autry. I chose JT.
"Just remember, you wanted this," he said. "I didn't make you come here today. I didn't tell you about this. You wanted this."
He pressed his finger into my chest every time he said "you." I sensed that despite our last conversation, JT felt I was slipping from his grasp.
"I know," I said. "Don't worry."
"I'm not worried."
He let out a sinister laugh. "But you should really think about this. Just remember, I didn't bring you here. I can't protect you. Not all the time, anyway. You did this on your own. I get it. I'm on my own. JT smiled, pressed his finger into my chest one last time with force, and walked away. Chapter 4. Gang Leader for a Day. After nearly 3 years of hanging out with JT, I began talking to several of my professors about my dissertation topic. As it happened, they weren't as enthusiastic as I was about an in-depth study of the Black King's crack gang and its compelling leader. They were more interested in the standard sociological issues in the community, entrenched poverty, domestic violence, the prevalence of guns, residents' charged relations with the government, and, to a lesser extent, how the community dealt with the gang. If I explored these subjects well, my professor said, I could explain how the Robert Taylor tenants really behaved, rather than simply arguing that they didn't act like middle-class people. Bill Wilson, in particular, was adamant that I adopt a wider lens on the gang and its role in Robert Taylor. Because sociology had such a strong tradition of community studies, he wanted me to write the definitive report on everyday life in high-rise housing projects. He also said he'd started worrying about my safety in the projects. By this point, I had taken up golf as a way to spend more time with Wilson, an avid golfer.
"I'm having nightmares, Sudhir," he said once in the middle of the fairway, staring out blankly. "You're worrying me, and I really want you to think about spending some time with others."
He drifted off, never instructing me about which others I should be observing, but I knew this was code for anyone besides the gang. I knew he had my best interests in mind, but it still came as a shock to me that I would have to widen my focus if I still planned to base my dissertation on this community. It meant that JT wouldn't be the sole target of my attention, and perhaps not even the primary target. A few of my professors were seasoned ethnographers, experts in the methodology of first-hand observation. They were insistent that I avoid getting so close to any one source that I would be beholden to him. Easier said than done. I hadn't forgotten how agitated JT became when he saw me branching out into the community. I really didn't feel I could tell him that my project was moving away from a focus on his leadership. By now, JT wasn't my only access to the community, but he was certainly my best access. He was the one who had brought me in, and he was the one who could open or shut any door. But beyond all that lay one simple fact. JT was a charismatic man who led a fascinating life that I wanted to keep learning about. JT seemed to appreciate having the ear of an outsider who would listen for hours to his tales of bravado and managerial prowess. He often expressed how hard it was to oversee the gang, to keep the drug economy running smoothly, and to deal with the law-abiding tenants who saw him as an adversary. Sometimes he spoke of his job with dispassion, as if he were the CEO of some widget manufacturer, an attitude that I found not only jarring, but, given the violence and destruction his enterprise caused, irresponsible. He fancied himself a philanthropist as much as a leader. He spoke proudly of quitting his mainstream sales job in downtown Chicago to return to the projects and use his drug profits to help others. How did he help? He mandated that all his gang members get a high school diploma and stay off drugs. He gave money to some local youth centers for sports equipment and computers. He willingly loaned out his gang members to Robert Taylor tenant leaders, who deployed them on such tasks as escorting the elderly on errands or beating up a domestic abuser. JT could even put a positive spin on the fact that he made money by selling drugs. A drug economy, he told me, was useful for the community, since it redistributed the drug addict's money back into the community via the gang's philanthropy. I have to admit that JT's rhetoric could be persuasive, even when I tried to play the skeptic. The fact was, I didn't yet have a good grip on how his gang really affected the broader community. On an even more basic level, I wondered if I really had a complete sense of what JT did on a daily level. What kind of gang activities wasn't he showing me? One cold February morning, I stood with him on a street corner as he met with one of his drug-selling crews. I was shivering, still unaccustomed to the chilling lake winds, and trying hard to focus on what JT was saying. He spoke to his men about the need to take pride in their work. He was also trying to motivate the younger members to brave the cold and sell as much crack as they could. In weather like this, the youngest members had to stand outside and sell, while the ones with more seniority hung out in a building lobby. After addressing his troops, JT said he was going off to play basketball. He climbed into his Malibu, and I climbed in with him. We were parked near a busy intersection at State Street, within view of a Robert Taylor high-rise, some low-rise stores, and the Boys and Girls Club. Before he even turned the key, I mentioned, half-joking, that I thought he was seriously overpaid. "I don't see what's so difficult about your job," I said. "I mean, you say how hard it is to do what you do, but I just can't see it being that difficult." "All I ever saw him do," I said, "was walk around and shake hands with people, spend money, drive nice cars, he owned at least three that I knew of, and party with his friends." JT just sat for a moment, making no move to drive off. "Okay, well, you want to give it a try? If you think it's so easy, you try it." "I don't think that would be possible. I don't think graduate school is really training me to lead a gang." "Yeah, but you don't think I need any skills at all to do this, so you should have no problem doing it, right?" It was true that sometimes his job looked hard. When his gang was warring with another gang, for instance, JT had to coordinate his troops and motivate 15-year-old kids to stand out in the open and sell drugs, despite the heightened risk of being shot, beaten up, or arrested. And it wasn't as though these kids were getting rich for their trouble. The BKs, like most other street gangs, had a small leadership class. JT kept only a few officers on his payroll, a treasurer, a couple of enforcers, a security coordinator, and then a set of lesser-paid directors who managed the six-person teams that did the actual street-level selling of crack. But for the most part, it seemed that JT's gang members spent their time hanging around on street corners, selling drugs, shooting dice, playing sports, and talking about women. Did it really take a self-styled CEO to manage that? I expressed this sentiment to JT. "I could do it," I said. "Probably. I mean, I don't think I could handle a war, and I've never shot a gun, so it depends on what you mean when you say, try it." "Just that. Try it. There's no war on right now, no fighting. So you don't even have to touch a gun. But I can't promise that you won't have to do something you may not like." "Such as?" "I'm not telling you. You said you think it's easy, so you do it, and you'll see what I mean." "Is this an offer?" "Nigger, this is the offer of a lifetime. Guaranteed that if you do this, you'll have a story for all your college friends." He suggested that I try it for a day. This made me laugh. How could I possibly learn anything worthwhile in a single day? From inside the car, I watched as parents gingerly stepped out of the high-rise lobby, kids in tow, trying to get to school and out of the unforgiving lake wind. A crossing guard motioned them to hurry up and cross the street, for there were a couple of 18-wheelers idling impatiently at a green light. As they passed his car, JT waved. A breath was fogging up the windshield. He turned on the defroster, jacked the music a bit louder. "One day," he said. "Take it or leave it. That's all I'm saying. One day." I met JT at 7:30 the next morning at Kevin's Hamburger Heaven in Bridgeport, a predominantly Irish-American neighborhood across the expressway from the projects. This was his regular morning spot. "None of these white folks here know me," he said, "so I don't get any funny looks." His steak and eggs arrived just as I sat down. He always ate alone, he said. Soon enough, he'd be joined by two of his officers, Price and T-Bone. Even though JT's gang was nearly twice as large as most others on the South Side, he kept his officer class small, because he trusted very few people. All of his officers were friends he'd known since high school. "All right," he began. "Let's talk a little about..." "Listen," I blurted out, "I can't kill anybody. I can't sell shit to anybody. I had been awake much of the night worrying, or even plan any of that stuff. Not me." "Okay, nigger. First of all, you need to stop shouting." He looked about the room. "And stop worrying. But let me tell you what I'm worried about, Chief." He twirled a piece of steak on his fork as he dabbed his mouth with a napkin. "I can't let you do everything, right? Because I'll get into trouble, you dig? So there's just going to be some stuff you can't do. and you already told me some of the other stuff you don't want to be doing. But all that doesn't matter, because I got plenty of stuff to keep you busy for the day, and only the cats coming for breakfast know what you'll be doing. So don't be acting like you run the place in front of everybody. Don't embarrass me. It was his own bosses, JT explained, that he was worried about. The Black King's board of directors. The board, roughly 24 men who controlled all the neighborhood BK gangs in Chicago, kept a close eye on drug revenues, since their generous skim came off the top. They were always concerned that local leaders like JT keep their troops in line. Young gang members who made trouble drew unwanted police attention, which made it harder to sell drugs. The fewer drugs that were sold, the less money the board collected. So the board was constantly reminding JT to minimize the friction of his operation. As JT was explaining all this, he repeated that only his senior officers knew that I was gang leader for a day. It wouldn't do, he said, for the gang's rank and file to learn of our experiment, nor the community at large. I was excited at the thought of spending the day with JT. I felt he might not be able to censor what I saw if I was with him for a full day. It was also an obvious sign that he trusted me, and I think he was flattered that I was interested in knowing what actually went into his work. Impatient, I asked him what my first assignment was. You'll find out in a minute, as soon as I do. Eat up, you're going to need it. I was nervous, to be sure, but not because I was implicating myself in an illegal enterprise. In fact, I hadn't even really thought about that angle. I probably should have. At most universities, faculty members solicit approval for their research from institutional review boards, which act as the main insurance against exploitative or unethical research. But the work of graduate students is largely overlooked. Only later, when I began sharing my experiences with my advisors and showing them my field notes, did I begin to understand and adhere to the reporting requirements for researchers who are privy to criminal conduct. But at the time, with little understanding of these protocols, I simply relied on my own moral compass. This compass wasn't necessarily reliable. To be honest, I was a bit overwhelmed by the thrill of further entering JT's world. I hoped he would someday introduce me to the powerful Black King's leadership, the reputedly ruthless inner-city gang lords who had since transplanted themselves to the Chicago suburbs. I wondered if they were some kind of revolutionary vanguard, debating the theories of Karl Marx and W.E.B. Du Bois, Frantz Fanon, and Kwame Nkrumah. Probably not. I also hoped that JT would bring me to some dark downtown tavern, where large Italian men in large Italian suits met with black hustlers like JT to dream up a multi-ethnic, multi-generational, multi-million-dollar criminal plan. My mind, it was safe to say, was racing out of control. Price and T-Bone soon arrived and sat down at our table. By now I knew these two pretty well, T-Bone the gang's bookish and chatty treasurer, which meant he handled most of the gang's fiscal and organizational issues, and Price, the thuggish and hard-living security chief, a job that included the allocation of particular street corners to particular BK dealers. They were the two men most responsible for helping JT with day-to-day affairs. They both nodded in my direction as they sat down, then looked toward JT. "Okay, T-Bone," JT said. "You're up, nigger. Talk to me. What's happening today?"
Whoa, I said. "I'm in charge here. No, I should call this meeting to order. No."
"Okay, nigger," JT said, again glancing around. He still seemed to be concerned that I was talking too loud. "Just be cool." I tried to calm down. "T-Bone, you're up. Talk to me, nigger." JT collapsed on the table, laughing hard. T-Bone and Price laughed along with him. "If he calls me nigger again, I'm giving him an ass-whoopin'," T-Bone said. "I don't care if he's my leader." JT told T-Bone to go ahead and start listing the day's tasks. "Miss Bailey needs about a dozen guys to clean up the building today," T-Bone said. "Last night Josie and them partied all night long, and there's shit everywhere. We need to send guys to her by 11, or she will be pissed. And I do not want to be dealing with her when she's pissed. Not me."
"Okay, Sue dear," JT said. "What do we do?"
He folded his arms and sat back, as if he'd just set up a checkmate.
"What? Are you kidding me? Is this a joke?"
"Ain't no joke," said T-Bone flatly. "What do I do?" He looked at J.T., who pointed his finger at me.
"Come on, Chief," T-Bone said to me. "I got about 10 things I need to go over. Let's do this."
J.T. explained that he had to keep Miss Bailey happy since the gang sold crack in the lobby of her building, and as building president, she had the power to make things difficult. To appease her, J.T. regularly assigned his members to clean up her building and do other menial jobs. The young drug dealers hated these assignments, not only because they were humiliating, but because every hour of community service was one less hour earning money. Josie was a teenage member of JT's gang, who'd apparently thrown a party with some prostitutes and left the stairwells and gallery strewn with broken glass, trash, and used condoms. "All right, who hasn't done cleanup in a while?" I asked.
"Well, you have Moochie's group and Kalia's group," T-Bone said. "Both of them ain't cleaned up for about 3 months."
Moochie and Kalia were each in charge of a 6-member sales force.
"Okay, how do we make a decision between the two?" I asked.
"Well, it depends on what you think is important," J.T. said. "Moochie's been making tall money, so you may not want to pull him off the streets. Kalia ain't been doing so hot lately, so maybe you want him to clean up, 'cause he isn't bringing in money anyway."
T-Bone countered by saying that maybe I should give the cleanup job to Moochie because he was making so much money lately.
"A little community service," T-Bone said, "might ensure that Moochie's head doesn't get too big." One of a leader's constant struggles was to keep younger members from feeling too powerful or independent. Then Price threw in the fact that Moochie, who was in his early 20s, had been sleeping with Miss Bailey, who was about 55. This news shocked me. Was Moochie really attracted to a heavy-set woman in her 50s? Price explained that younger guys often slept with older women, especially in winter, because otherwise they might not have a warm, safe place to spend the night. Also, a leaseholding woman might let her younger boyfriend stash drugs and cash in her apartment, and maybe even use it as a freelance sales spot.
"Maybe Miss Bailey gets to liking Moochie, and she tells everyone not to buy shit from anyone but his boys," Price said. "You can't have that, because Moochie feels like he owns the building, and he doesn't."
"What if I flip a coin?" I asked, frustrated that I was spending so much time delegating janitorial duties.
"I mean, you can't win one way or the other."
"Giving up already?" J.T. asked.
"Okay, let's send Moochie over there," I said. "It's better that his head doesn't get too big. Short run, you lose a little money."
"You got it," T-Bone said, and stepped away to make a phone call. Price brought up the next item. The BKs had been trying to find a large space, a church or school or youth center, where they could hold meetings. There were several occasions, J.T. explained, when the gang needed to gather all its members. If a member violated a major gang rule, J.T. liked to mete out punishment in front of the entire membership in order to encourage solidarity and, just as important, provide deterrence. If a member was caught stealing drugs, for instance, he might be brutally beaten in front of the whole gang. J.T. might also call a large meeting to go over practical matters like sales strategies or suspicions about who might be snitching to the police. A big meeting also gave J.T. a captive audience for his oratory. I had already been to a few meetings in which the only content was a 2-hour speech by J.T. on the virtues of loyalty and bravery. He often called the gang together on a street corner or in a park, but this was far from ideal. There were about 250 young men in JT's gang. Summoning even 50 of them to the same street corner was sure to bring out the police, especially if a beating was on the agenda. I was curious about the gang's relationship with the police, but it was very hard to fathom. Gang members brazenly sold drugs in public. Why, I wondered, didn't the cops just shut down these open-air markets? But I couldn't get any solid answers to this question. J.T. was always evasive on the issue, and most people in the neighborhood were scared to talk about the cops at all, even more scared, it seemed to me, than to talk about the gang. As someone who grew up in a suburb where the police were a welcome presence, I found this bizarre. But there was plainly a lot that I didn't yet understand. The Black Kings also needed to meet en masse if they were preparing for war with another gang. Once in a while, a war began when teenage members of different gangs got into a fight that then escalated, but leaders like J.T. had a strong incentive to thwart this sort of conflict, since it jeopardized money-making for no good reason. More typically, a war broke out when one gang tried to take over a sales location that belonged to another gang. Or one gang might do a drive-by shooting in another gang's territory, hoping to scare off its customers, perhaps right into the territory of the gang that did the shooting. When this kind of spark occurred, JT might pick up the phone and call his counterpart in the other gang to arrange a compromise. But more often, gang leaders ordered a retaliation in order to save face. One drive-by shooting begat a retaliatory drive-by. If a Black Kings dealer got robbed of his drugs or cash by someone from another gang, then the Black Kings would do at least the same. The retaliation was what signaled the start of a war. In JT's gang, it was the security officer, Price, who oversaw the details of the war, posting sentries, hiring mercenary gunmen if need be, planning the drive-bys. Price enjoyed this work and was often happiest during gang wars. I had never seen a war last beyond a few weeks. The higher-ups in each gang understood that public violence was, at the very least, bad for business. Usually, after a week or 10 days of fighting, the leaders would find a mediator, someone like Autry, to help forge a truce.
"Pastor Wilkins says we can meet once a week at the church at night," Price said. "I spoke to him yesterday. He says he would like a donation."
Price started to chuckle. So did T-Bone, who had returned from his phone call, and J.T. "What's so funny?" I asked.
"Pastor Wilkins is a faggot, man," J.T. said. "That nigger sucks dick all night long."
I had no idea whether Pastor Wilkins really did have sex with men, but I didn't think it much mattered. Price and the others enjoyed making fun of him, and that was that.
"I still don't see what's so funny," I said.
"Nigger, you have to meet with him," T-Bone said. "Alone."
"Oh, I get it. Very funny. Well, how about this? Since I'm the leader, then that meeting is now scheduled for tomorrow."
"Ha!"
"No. The pastor wants to meet today," J.T. said, suddenly stern, "and I need to find out today if we have a place to meet on Friday, so you're up, brown man. Get ready."
"All right, then. I'm delegating T-Bone to visit Pastor Wilkins. Now, you can't tell me that I can't delegate."
"Actually, I can," J.T. said. "It says in the gang's rule that only the leader can make these kind of meetings."
"Now you guys are making shit up. But fine, I'll do it. I say we give him $50 for the use of the church."
"What?" Price said. "Are you crazy?"
"50 will just make sure the cops arrive on time," T-Bone said. "You better think a little higher."
"Well, what did we pay last time?" I asked.
"It depends," J.T. said, explaining that it was not uncommon for the less well-established clergy to rent out their storefront spaces to the gangs for business meetings. 500 gets you the back room or the basement, but that's just one time, and the pastor stays in the building. 750 gets you the place to yourself, and sometimes you want to be by yourself, depending on what you're going to discuss.
"Yeah," Price chimed in. "If you have to beat somebody's ass, you might want to be alone."
I asked for a little time to think things over. The four of us left the restaurant and got into JT's Malibu for our next task. A meeting with Johnny, a man who owned a convenience store and no longer allowed members of the Black Kings inside. I already knew Johnny. He was a local historian of sorts who liked to regale me with stories of the 1960s and 1970s when he was a gang leader himself. But he stressed how the gangs of that period were totally different. They were political organizations, he said, fighting police harassment and standing up for the community's right to a fair share of city services. In his view, today's gangs were mostly money-making outfits with little understanding of or commitment to the needs of Chicago's poor black population. Johnny's store was on 47th Street, a busy commercial strip that bisected Robert Taylor. The strip was lined with liquor stores, check-cashing shops, party supply and hardware stores, a few burned-out buildings and empty lots, a public assistance center, two beauty salons, and a barber shop. I wasn't very worried about meeting with Johnny until Price spoke up.
"We've also got a problem with this nigger," he said, "because he's been charging us more than he charges other niggers."
"You mean he rips off only people in the Black Kings?" I asked.
"That's right," said J.T., "and this one is hard because Johnny is T-Bone's uncle. He's also a dangerous motherfucker. He'll use a gun just like that, so you got to be careful."
"No, you have to be careful," I said. "I told you I won't use a gun."
"No one says you have to," Price offered, laughing from the back seat. "But he might."
"What exactly is it that I'm supposed to do?" I asked. "You want me to make him charge you fair prices?" "Well, this is a tough one," J.T. said, "because we can't have people taking advantage of us, you dig? But the thing is, we provide this nigger protection."
"Protection?"
"Yeah, say somebody steals something, then we find out who did it and we deal with it."
"So he can't tell us that we can't come in his store," Price said, "not if we're providing him a service."
"Right," said J.T. "We have to try and remind him that he's paying us to help him, and it doesn't look good if he doesn't let us come in his store. See, what he's doing is trying to make back the money he's paying us for protection." Johnny was out front when we pulled up, smoking a cigarette.
"What's up, Sue dear?" he said. "I see you're wasting your time again, hanging around these niggers."
Johnny looked like a caricature of a disco-era hustler. Bright orange pants, a polyester shirt that appeared to be highly flammable, cowboy boots with fake diamond trim and lots of ghetto glitter, fake rubies and other stones on his fingers. A tattoo on his arm read, "Black Bitch," and another on his chest said, "Penthouse Kings," which was the name of his long-ago street gang. J.T., Price, and I followed Johnny into the back of the store while T-Bone peeled off to attend some other business. The back room was musty and unswept. The walls were plastered with pictures of naked black women and a big poster of Walter Payton, the beloved Chicago Bears running back. The sturdy shelves and even the floor were crammed with used TV sets, stereo components, and microwaves that Johnny fixed and sold. A big wooden table held the remnants of last night's poker game, cards and chips, cigar butts, some brandy, and a ledger tallying debts. Through the open back door, a small homeless encampment was visible. J.T. had told me that Johnny paid a homeless couple $50 a week to sleep outside and watch over the store. We all sat down around the table. Johnny seemed impatient.
"All right," he said. "What are we going to do?"
"Well, we were thinking more like, what were you going to do, nigger?" Price said.
"Listen, Big Black," Johnny said, cigarette dancing in his lips. "You can take that mouth outside if you can't say something useful."
J.T. told Price to go back to the car, leaving just me, J.T., and Johnny.
"You're paying us, Johnny," J.T. said, "and now you're charging us. You're trying to make your money back, is that it?"
Johnny replied in a calm monotone.
"You niggas charge me $250 a month, and that shit has to stop," he said. "A man can't run a business if he has to pay that kind of money. And your boys keep coming in here demanding free shit. I told Moochie and the rest of them that if they come in here anymore, this .22 is going to find their back." He gestured to a rifle hanging behind him on the wall.
"See now, that's the kind of talk we don't need," J.T. said. "I mean, we need to cooperate."
"Cooperate my ass," said Johnny. "You can cooperate with my fist."
"Whoa, whoa," I yelled, trying to be useful. "Let's calm down now, boys. What I think we need is a little..."
"Is this Arab going to sit here all day with us?"
Johnny said.
"Leave that boy alone," J.T. said. "I'll explain later." He shot me a glance, a shut-the-fuck-up glance.
"Listen. You pay me $200 a month and you'll get the same shit from us." He was talking about the protection the gang afforded. "And I'll talk to Moochie and everyone else. Tell them they can't steal shit, okay?"
"Bitch, you better tell him not to bring his girlfriends up in here."
"What?"
"You heard me. He brings them bitches in here when I'm not around, showing off and taking shit off the shelves, eating candy and drinking soda like he owns the place. When my man tried to do something about it, he pulled a gun on him. Let him bring that shit on me. Try it once, I'll kill the little bitch."
"All right," J.T. said, putting his hand in front of Johnny's face to shut him up. "I told you I'll deal with the nigger."
"I pay you $200 and your boys get to come in here, but they have to promise to spend at least $200 a month on shit," Johnny said.
"And you're not going to jack up prices, right?" I said.
"Goddamn Arab, you still here?"
Johnny said.
"Yeah, that's right, they pay what everyone else pays."
"Okay then," I said. "We got ourselves a deal, boys." I stood up to go.
"Boy, sit your ass down," J.T. said.
Johnny, we'll get back with you.
Yeah, we'll get back with you, I said. We need to deliberate.
Johnny and JT started laughing.
God damn, Johnny shouted. You bring this Arab with you wherever you go?
One day, JT muttered, clearly frustrated that I was taking my role a little too seriously. One day, that's it.
We got back into Malibu. Price drove, JT rode shotgun, and I sat in the back.
My next duty, JT explained, was to settle a dispute between two gang members, Billy and Otis. Billy was the director of a 6-man drug-selling crew. Otis, one of his 6 dealers, was claiming that Billy had underpaid him for a day's work. Billy, meanwhile, said that Otis lied about how much crack he sold and kept the extra money. My dilemma would be compounded by the fact that I already knew both Billy and Otis. As we drove, Price explained my goal: to adjudicate the case and determine a fair punishment. If Billy didn't pay Otis, then you have to punish Billy, he said. The punishment for not paying one of your members would be 2 mouth shots, and Billy can't work for a week. And if you want, you get to make Otis the director for that week. But if Otis stole something, then we have a bigger problem. You have to beat the shit out of that nigger, not just hit him twice. And he has to work free for a month. The thought of hitting someone in the face, delivering a mouth shot, made me nauseous. Growing up, I used to get picked on all the time. I was tall and athletic, but I was also a nerd, complete with pocket protector, bad haircut, and an armful of math and science books. I was a perfect target for the average football player or any other jock, especially since I played the less manly sports of tennis and soccer. I never even learned to throw a punch. In school, most of the fights culminated with someone, most often a girl I was with, pleading for the bully to reconsider, or with me rolling up in a fetal ball, which I actually found to be quite a good strategy, since most bullies didn't want to fight someone who wouldn't fight back. Now, I don't mean to be picky, I said, but isn't this why we have you here, Price? I mean, you're the security guy, no? You beat their ass. I mean, isn't that what you get paid for? And if I'm the leader, I can delegate, no? Sudhir, JT said, you have to realize that if you do that, then you lose respect. They need to see that you are the boss, which means that you hand out the beating.
What if I make them do 20 push-ups or 50 squat thrusts? Or maybe they have to clean my car?
You don't own a car, JT said.
That's right, so they have to clean your car for a month.
Listen, these guys already clean my car, wipe my ass, whatever I want, so that ain't happening, JT said calmly, as if wanting to make sure I understood the breadth of his power. And if they can steal money or not pay somebody for working and they only have to clean a car, then think how much these guys will steal. You have to make sure they understand they can't be stealing. Nigga, they need to fear you.
So that's your leadership style? Fear? I was trying to give the impression that I had my own style. Mostly, I was stalling out of worry that I'd have to throw a punch.
Fear, huh? Very interesting. Very interesting.
We pulled up to the street corner where Billy and Otis had been told to meet us. It was cold, not quite noon, but the sun had broken through a bit. Aside from a nearby gas station, the corner was surrounded mostly by empty lots and abandoned buildings. I watched Billy and Otis saunter over. Billy was about 6'6". He had been a star basketball player at Dunbar High School and won a scholarship to Southern Illinois at Carbondale, a small downstate school. He began using his connections with the Black Kings to deal marijuana and cocaine to students in his dorm. He eventually decided to quit the basketball team to sell drugs full-time. He once told me that the lure of cash made my mouth water, and I couldn't get enough of it. Dumbest move I ever made. Now he was working in the gang to save money in hopes of returning to college. I always liked Billy. He was one of thousands of people in this neighborhood who, by the time they turned 18, had made all sorts of important decisions by themselves. Fewer than 40% of the adults in the neighborhood had even graduated from high school, much less college, so Billy didn't have a lot of places to go for counsel. Even so, he was the first one to accept responsibility for bad decisions he'd made. I'll never forget what he said when he moved back to the projects after dropping out of college. I just needed someone to talk to. My mind was racing out of control, and I had no one to talk to. I didn't want to think about hitting Billy today because I really liked him, and because, at that height, his jaw was nearly out of reach. Otis was a different story. He always wore dark sunglasses, even indoors, even in winter, and he kept a large knife underneath a long black jacket that he always wore, even in hot weather. He loved to cut people up and give them a scar, and he didn't like me at all. This acrimony stemmed from a basketball game several months earlier. I regularly attended the gang's midnight games at the Boys and Girls Club. If Autry came up one referee short, he sometimes pressed me into service. I had played basketball growing up, but not how it was played in the ghetto. In my neighborhood, we set picks, passed the ball, and, perhaps most important, called fouls, even in pickup games. In the gang games, if you called even half the fouls that were actually committed, you'd run out of players by halftime. But during one game I refereed when Otis was playing, I called 5 quick fouls on him because, well, because he fouled somebody 5 times. He had to leave the game. From the bench, with a cheap bottle of liquor in his hand, Otis shouted at me, "I'm gonna kill you, motherfucker! I'm gonna cut your balls off!" It was pretty hard to concentrate for the rest of the game. I left the gym immediately afterward, but Otis chased me down in the parking lot. He was still in his uniform, so he didn't have his machete with him. He picked up a bottle from the asphalt, smashed it, and pressed the jagged edge to my neck. Just then, Autry hustled into the parking lot, pulled Otis back, and told me to run. I stood there in shock while Autry kept yelling, "Run, nigger, run!" After about 30 seconds, he and Otis both started laughing, because my feet simply wouldn't move. They laughed so hard that they crumpled to the ground. I nearly threw up. I was thinking of this incident now, as Otis walked toward us, and I wondered if he was too. I got out of the car along with JT and Price. "Okay, let's hear what happened," JT said. "I need to know who fucked up last week. Billy, you first." JT seemed preoccupied, maybe a little upset. I didn't know why, and it wasn't the time to ask. It certainly didn't seem as if I had much chance of leading the conversation.
"Like I already said," Billy began, "ain't nothing to say. Otis got 100-pack and was $100 short. I want my money." He was stubborn and defiant.
"Nigger, please," Otis said. "You ain't paid me for a week. You owed me that money."
Otis's eyes were bloodshot, and he looked as if he might reach out and hit Billy at any moment.
"Didn't pay?" said Billy. "You're wrong on that. I paid you, and you went out that night party, and I remember."
The director of a sales team, in this case Billy, usually gave his street dealers an allotment of prepackaged crack. 100-pack was the standard. A single bag sold for $10, so once the dealer exhausted his inventory, he was supposed to give his director $1,000. Billy was saying that Otis had turned over just $900. Otis's only defense seemed to be that Billy owed him money from an earlier transaction, a charge that Billy denied. Otis and Billy kept arguing with each other, but they were looking at JT, Price, and me pleading their cases.
"Okay, okay," JT said. "This ain't going nowhere. Get the fuck out of here. I'll be back with you later."
Billy and Otis walked away, joining the rest of their crew near some dumpsters where they stored their drugs and money. Once they were out of earshot, JT turned to me. "Well, what do you think? You heard enough?"
"Yes, I did," I said proudly. "Here's my decision. Otis clearly took the money and pocketed it. You notice that he never actually denied taking something. He just said that he was owed the money by Billy. Now, I can't tell whether Billy never paid Otis for the day's work, but the fact that Otis didn't deny stealing the money makes me feel that Billy forgot to pay Otis, or maybe he didn't want to. But all that doesn't matter, because Otis did steal some money, and I bet Billy didn't pay."
There was silence for about 30 seconds. Finally, Price spoke up.
"Hey, I like it. Not bad. That was the smartest thing you said all day."
"Yeah," said JT. "Now, what's the penalty?"
"Well, in this case, we borrow from the NFL and invoke the offsetting penalty rule," I said. "Both guys screwed up, so the two penalties cancel each other out. I know that Otis's crime is more serious because he stole, but both of them messed up.
so no one gets hurt or pays a fine. How about that? More silence. Price watched JT for his reaction. I did the same. Tell Otis to come over here, JT finally said. Price went to fetch him. What are you going to do? I asked.